Andy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer, on News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter. Talk lines are open now at 314-912-1019.
Welcome back to the program. 8:25, just a little bit, we're going to be talking to Waleed Faris about what's really going on in the Middle East. He has his finger on the pulse, of course, being from that part of the world, being from Lebanon, and of course, being an expert in the subject matter. Dr. Faris will join us at 8:25. Right now, we have a caller on the line. We've talked about EV, the green energy breakdown, EVs being abandoned by manufacturers. The energy grid doesn't support it. Welcome to the Tobler Show, caller. How you doing?
Doing well.
What are your thoughts?
I have not seen or heard anything on your station in regards to Mitch McConnell's sister-in-law, Angela Chow, C-H-A-O, sister of his wife. Anyway, she backed into a pond in her property. I believe that's in Texas. It was late at night. And anyway, she had an electric car. And she didn't know what to do about it. But she called a friend to ask about what to do about the electric car in the pond. So anyway, I guess that friend called the ambulance or emergency people.
I didn't hear about that. I didn't get Angela Chow.
You can Google it. This happened on February the 11th. And Mitch...
Oh, she drowned after accidentally reversing her Tesla into a pond in Texas Ranch. Oh, I'm seeing this on the Independent now. Yeah. Huh.
That happened on the 11th of February, and Mitch resigned on the 28th.
Oh, my. Yeah. This woman was Angela Chow, was the chair and chief executive of the Chow Family Business, the Foremost Group shipping company. Huh.
That's right.
She put her electric vehicle into reverse, causing it to slam into a pond and sink, with first responders unable to get it out in time to save her life, according to the Wall Street Journal. Wow. Interesting. Well, I guess it can happen whether your vehicle is electric or not, huh?
It's true, yes. But there was so much confusion with it, even with the rescue people. They were afraid that possibly they could be electrocuted with this electric car. They didn't know, you know, nobody's been told, you know, what could happen with that. Mm. So it kind of put them in a bad mess too.
Wow. I don't know if there's any manganese in those batteries, but you put manganese in with water and it just creates a toxic of plume and fire and everything. Maybe, I don't know, maybe they were worried about that. I know lithium, I don't know if lithium does that if it gets in water, but hey, well, thank you for that. I hadn't heard it. Well, now you brought it to the air. That's why we love when our listeners bring us information like that. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
I wanted to tell you, I live in Brownsburg, Indiana.
You do? Wow. Are you listening to us online? Or are you streaming us on Rumble or Facebook? Or how do you hear us?
I'm not sure what it is. It's on an app. That's all I know. I'm 83 years old, so I'm not sure
what it is. Well, I want to ask you something. Okay, you're 83 years old. Wow, great. Thank you for listening. What do you think about our discussion? I don't know if you heard the discussion last hour about frustrated young white males who can't, and Jerome, my producer, is among those. Great resume, superb academic experience and, awards, leadership, volunteerism, frankly, a model American citizen. And yet he can't get a look when he puts in hundreds of job applications because he happens to have a Y chromosome and be Caucasian. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we're a mixed up world. And I think Satan has really worked on that particular mixing up the transgenders and all this stuff. It's ruining our country.
What do you think about the desecration of over the last several decades and the demeaning of the traditional homemaker model for women as an anchor of the family, and how that's really been considered sort of a second-class citizen by society? Do you think that's appropriate, or has it been a big mistake?
It's been a big mistake.
Were you a homemaker with a family, or what was your life story?
I'm an RN, and I actually went to England for midwifery and came back there to Bowling Green and worked at the county hospital there for several years. Wow. But I was never allowed to use my midwifery there because the doctors did not want to lose the money. They did not want somebody, you'd think they'd want somebody to deliver babies in the middle of the night, wouldn't you?
All right. Well, hey, I support well-trained midwives. You know, we have a problem in Missouri. It was actually a Republican legislator years ago. He and I got into it on the air and off the air. And I mean, we got, it was friendly, spirited debate, but under the cloak of a midnight insurance law, he put into place lay midwifery, where all that women had to do wanted to be lay midwives. They're unregulated. There's no oversight, no nothing. And they can deliver babies in their basement or in their garage. And all they have to have is so-called tokological training. Crazy, huh?
Right. I remember that. Yeah. I was there when that happened. And
That was Senator John Loudon. I remember that. All right. Hey, well, thank you for the call. Really appreciate it. Thanks for weighing in.
My sister also listens from New Jersey on her app, on her phone, too. We listen almost 24 hours a day to your station.
Wow. Well, we really appreciate that. We'll pass that along. Make sure you call us more frequently, would you?
Okay. All right. I'll try to get her to call, maybe.
Please do. We'd love to talk to New Jersey, hear about the earthquake.
She said she didn't know anything about it, except it's new.
Okay. Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. God bless. All right. Interesting call, huh, Jerome?
Oh, yeah. I had never even considered that if a electric vehicle gets stuck in, you know, a pond or just a very moist environment. I know certain chemicals can actually erupt if they interact with water, such as lye, which I'm not saying is in the EVs, but that really gave me some food for thought. I'm not the biggest. I actually tried to help an electric vehicle that broke down. I tried to jump it with my car and it killed my battery. So I'm definitely not a fan of them after that, but very, very thoughtful. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, well, there was probably no power to jump, right? It wasn't a matter of getting a combustion engine started. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? You'd have to there's not enough power in your car to power that vehicle because that's totally dependent. All right. So we were talking about this issue with white males and, you know, how they're being rejected in society, both young and old. And I promised the listeners that I would share a communication from a very good friend and listener to the program when we were talking about it. This person was at a conference with a large organization, large company. And the way it started, I can't believe this. And here's the quotes. This is the way this conference started. Large, well-known American company. Look around. There are too many white men in the room. Close quote. My friend and our listener called this highly offensive to many of us. Would you find that highly offensive? What happened if you walked into a room of NBA stars? Those of you who have kids in basketball, ask your child this, because they're being indoctrinated that if they're white, if they're male, that they're somehow an oppressor. Well, if they're white and a female, they're an oppressor. And let's just say they're in sports. Let's speculate that they're in basketball. Ask them what happens in a future world if they're on a team dominated by black players. And I believe the NBA is dominated with black players, isn't it?
Yes.
I have no problem with that. They seem to be the most talented players. That's why they're there for the most part. There's some talented white people too, but it seems like, I don't know why, but that's the way the market has rendered those teams to be composed of. I have no problems with it. But ask them what would happen if they would walk into the locker room and as a white basketball player, and they simply stated, wow, look around. There's too many black players in this room. what would happen? And what would be wrong with the picture that we know would happen, which would be they would be ostracized, they would be called racist, they would be excommunicated from not only the locker room, the team, any chance of ever playing in a league dominated by black players, they'd be thrown out of the stadium. They might even be prosecuted for hate speech. By the way, it's happening in Scotland. Since Scotland passed a very nebulous, wide-ranging anti-hate speech law, there's been more than 3,000 hate speech claims made to the government. I'm going to say what I know you people are thinking. There's many very, very, very honest and perfectly ethical and thankfully moral people of minorities. And yes, I know many of you women out there agree with me too, but you can't say it, can you? But we've come to a double standard where now it's okay for someone to talk about one direction of racism, but it's not okay to sort of follow that to its logical conclusion. Recently, there have been studies that purport to say that outcomes are better when black patients see black doctors. Well, okay, let's take that on face value. Let's concede that for the sake of argument. What would happen if you're white, or you're Asian, or you're lesbian, or you're gay, or you're transgender, and you walk in and you go up to the reception desk at the urgent care, at the emergency department, at the office of whatever specialist or primary care, and say, I'm requesting a lesbian doctor. I'm white. I want a white doctor only. What happens if you say that? John the First is on. Let's talk to John the First very briefly because we want to talk to Waleed Ferris. John, you always call with not enough time, man. Go ahead.
Oh, if you say so, Randy, here's my point, and not against Jerome. He seems like a nice young man, and I think you're very fortunate to have him. He's very well-spoken. My point is with young people graduating college, and I've seen this. I'm a software engineer. I also own a business, a rental. I own some rental properties. The trouble I see with young people looking for jobs, they want to start out at the top, even in the IT field, and I've interviewed numerous. What happens is young people graduating college pick a field and they expect to make top dollar, six figures, $100,000 to start. And when they come in and expecting that, and, you know, kids throw their GPAs at me. I don't care what you look like. I ask what they've done. What they've done, you know, and it doesn't, I don't care what their GPA is. I don't care what they, how many clubs they belong to. I want them, when I ask them questions, to look me in the eye and respond properly. Or, if they can't carry a conversation, because we're looking at bringing somebody in, we want to make sure that they fit cohesively with other people on the team. You know, you can have the highest GPA and the best resume, but if you can't work with others, you're not going to make it, or at least on the teams that I was interviewing for. And when they come up with salary, go ahead.
Yeah, no disagreement there, John, but I think that certainly there has to be some measure of merit, right? And I think a GPA is one of those. Being involved in extracurricular organizations and leadership and philanthropy, like Jerome says, that I think bespeaks a person's ability to communicate and do teamwork, right?
I looked at people, how they made it through college. Did they get grants? Were they super... Usually the ones with high GPAs and scholarships, I wanted the ones that had to work. I looked at like 2.5 to 3.2 GPA, but I really, I was more how they did it. If they went to college and held down a part-time job or a full-time job and struggled to make it through, with one parent, or, you know, they came from, that's what I was looking for. I was looking for the hard work to get there. And the, give me, you can give me a high GPA and low drive, or a low GPA and high drive to work in the work environment. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay, John, gotta run. Thank you. Thank you very much. But John, I think we almost agreed there. Here's the problem. I don't think you would have hired me. I had a high GPA, I had a scholarship, and I worked two jobs during college, medical school, okay, and into residency. Well, so I would have been unhirable. But thank you for the call. And I had two call. I had two parents. So there you go. I was privileged. You wouldn't have hired me. All right. Thanks a lot, John. No, good call. Good call. I agree with you. It's a lot of it has to do. I've always said that. Show me a person that has the basic raw skills of hard work, resilience, and ingenuity, and good communication skills, and I'll teach them what they need to know on the job. I'm Randy Tober. When we come back, Waleed Farris joins us. Update on the Mideast.
Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer, on News Talk STL. This is News Talk STL.
Welcome back to the program. It's always a real privilege and honor to talk with Dr. Waleed Farris, who is, of course, a foreign policy expert, co-secretary general of the Transatlantic Parliamentary Group, former advisor on Middle East to Donald Trump and Congress, professor, author, and prolific author on what's going on in the Middle East. One of his latest book, an imperialist Republican U.S. policy book called Iran, an imperialist Republican U.S. policy. Waleed Farris joins us now. Thank you for joining us. I think you're just off of a Newsmax appearance, right, Waleed?
That's correct. Jumping into your show immediately.
We appreciate it. Things are really that appear to be a tinderbox over in the Middle East, Waleed, with Iran now threatening. Apparently, Israel has blocked their, they've jammed their GPS so that people in Jerusalem think they're in Beirut and everything. I read that this morning in the Wall Street Journal. Tell us what's going on with Iran's alleged imminent retaliation on the Israeli attack on the Damascus consulate, and what this means for the area and the globe.
Well, first of all, the Iran regime, let's place it where it is. It's not that Tehran has relations with Hezbollah, relations with Hamas, you know, and they talk to each other from time to time. The Iran regime is the maestro of a very large regional orchestra of militias, well-armed, well-supplied by the Iran regime. And by the way, we can talk about that as well. We are feeding that machine by sending them billions of dollars, which is the largest scandal in my view. But the command in Iran is playing piano, as we say, with the Israelis, sometimes increasing escalation from Gaza against the Israelis, then ordering Hezbollah to lob missiles on the Galilee, then ordering attacks in Syria and in Iraq, not just on the Israelis, but on us as well. And when they want to ask the Houthis in Yemen to try to suffocate world economy. So the problem is not just Hamas and Israel, it's really the Iran regime and all their militias, and Israel, and the United States, and the international community. That's very important for the public to understand the nature of this war. There is a mother war led by Iran, and five wars on the ground also led by Iran. Now, what the Israelis were trying to do very quickly here is that trying to intercept or stop the advance of these militias that are coming from Iran to Iraq, to Syria, into Lebanon. It looks like the Israelis discovered or realized that the nexus of these militias in the northern front is around Damascus, and the command of the Iranians comes there and direct all the attacks against Israel. So they hit it, and apparently they scored hits against the Iranian militia. And now the regime, they say they have no choice but to retaliate. They are arming their ballistic missiles from Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and probably from Hezbollah in Lebanon. But what worries me is the possibility of the Iran control of a new battlefield, and that's Jordan. And Jordan basically is an ally to the West, to the United States, to Great Britain. But the events of last week drew my attention that they're preparing something out of Jordan into the capital of Jordan.
I saw this on your Twitter feed, and I thought, whoa, that is something I hadn't, it has not been reported. Dr. Farris's Twitter feed is at Waleed Farris, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. So Now, King Abdullah is a friend of the West, but is there a risk that he could flip in light of the intense and growing pressure, including now Joe Biden on a phone call to Bibi Netanyahu Thursday, that he could flip and become more sympathetic to Iran and less to Israel? I mean, where does this go?
No, not at all. I can say very clearly that the Hashemite kingdom, the government, those who are in control of the security agencies, they know that the main threat, they have two threats against them, but the main threat at this point in time is the Iran regime, which is massing militias on both borders of Jordan with Syria and Jordan with Iraq. Some of these ballistic missiles, as I said, have been fired from Iraq, from the borders, between Iraq and Jordan. Remember, a month ago, there was an incident on the Jordanian-Syrian border, and two or three of our soldiers have been killed by the Iranian militias out of Syria. Besides, we have a serious presence inside Jordan. Where does the supply come from when we hit in Iraq or in Syria? It comes from northern Jordan. So the chances that the government would flip, they know that if left alone with the Iranian regime, they would just eat them alive. So there is no chance. Second threat is the Muslim Brotherhood, which is well anchored inside Jordan. Hamas has many cells inside Jordan. The problem we have, the real problem we have, is that all Arab coalition governments, including Jordan, who have actually attended the Riyadh summit in 2017, if your listeners recall, when President Trump addressed 50 leaders of the Arab and Muslim world and asked them to drive the jihadists out, asked them to confront the Iranian militias. Now, what has changed was in Washington, the policy of this administration since 2021 is to offer the jihadists, you know, what they want. We offered them Afghanistan, right, Doctor? Afghanistan was given in 2021. We returned to the Iran deal. We offered them, you know, billions of dollars. We still have hostages inside Iran. So the concern of Arab moderate countries is not Iran or the Brotherhood. These are their foes. The concern is Washington. What is going on in Washington? Why this administration is actually serving as a supplier to the Iran regime in money? It's not secret. We see it in public. Or this partnership with the Muslim Brotherhood that supports Hamas. That's where the concern of Amman, Riyadh, Cairo, Abu Dhabi, Manama, and other countries are. It's
I am getting very, very frightened in real time here, Waleed, in what you just said. So we have Israel increasingly under assault, even from our own government. Biden now tying support for Israel to, quote, civilian protection in the wake of the mistaken attack on Gaza and the support workers for Gaza. But now you describe this growing northern front threat to Israel. I mean, it's a tiny country with limited resources, even with, you know, arms and material support from the U.S. I read that Israel has lowered the age for recruiting into the army. Can this small and fierce and resilient country fight that many fronts at the same time without some boots on the ground or air or other kinetic help from the West?
Absolutely. This is one of the best questions, actually the real question regarding the ongoing fight, at least till January 2025. And we don't know even what's going to happen at this point in time. I mean, I don't recall, even when there were crises between some administrations here, some governments there, you know, there were quite a few, you know, in the 90s and later on. I'm excluding the Trump time because that was a peak of relationship between Israel and the United States. But even if we look at the previous administrations, I'm saying Democrats, but also Republican, we have never seen an administration that is actually trying to outmaneuver Israel. What are you talking about? Imagine if, when we seized Afghanistan from the Taliban, that with Israel would come and say, hey, you're not paying attention, you're bombing here, you're bombing there. Who are we now to come and ask the Israelis to go by our norms? And our norms actually are the same as Israel during the previous wars. We took Afghanistan in 32 days. We took Iraq from the Ba'athist dictator for 35 days, maybe. And even the other democratic administrations, like they took Libya. They brought down Gaddafi, rightly or wrongly. So when we feel, as the United States, going after a bad actor, a dangerous actor, regardless of our discussions of politics that happens inside Congress, We don't expect our allies to come and say, hey, you don't have the right to do this. You have to have a ceasefire. Imagine, and France did it. France and Germany, when we went to Iraq, what did they do? They were pounding us, you know, ceasefire, stop, let Saddam Hussein breathe, et cetera, et cetera. That's what this administration is doing to Israel. What do we mean by ceasefire now? If we were in Normandy, would Switzerland tell us ceasefire now? This is all result, Doctor, of the commitment of this administration to the Iran deal. That is a transaction. There are a lot of billions of dollars that have been sent to the Iran regime. And I am pretty sure that the Iran regime sent it to many consultants, to many lobbies, you know, in the West, which is clear in Western Europe, but also here. So what this administration is doing is slowing down the Israeli advances to make sure that the Iran regime is happy and not withdraw from the Iran deal. It's all about a financial transaction.
Wow, man, this is something else. You know, the other day, something Antony Blinken was in the wake of this phone call and so forth was calling out Israel. And it's just unbelievably embarrassing to see the way this paternalistic approach that and disrespectful approach that our administration's taking. But at the end of that quote, at the end of that clip, he said, we have to make sure that, referring to that unfortunate mistaken attack on those aid workers, that this can never happen again. I don't remember those exact four words being used any time by Antony Blinken or Joe Biden. Maybe I missed it, but I don't remember that being stated so explicitly in the wake of the October 7th attack. Yeah. How come the administration isn't saying that can never happen again, and they should double down on defending Israel, the ugliness of what is needed, and that is the elimination of Hamas, who, after all, could control this by just surrendering and returning the hostages?
Absolutely. I mean, the minimum, the bare minimum that the administration should be in the business of doing is to put the pressure on Hamas, to put the pressure on the, you know, those who are leading Hamas, coordinating with Hamas, funding Hamas, namely in Qatar. Namely in Qatar, who are hosting the leaders of Hamas. So if Qatar is a friend and ally, as they say, well, that's the path. We go to Qatar and tell them, you pressure Hamas. We're going to pacify. We're going to disarm the militias. And even, why don't we go to the Arabs, our allies, you know, the Saudis, the UAE, Egypt, Bahrain, and tell them, why don't you help us if you want to help financially? So what we are trying to do, what we, meaning the administration, is trying to do, is actually help Iran and Hamas to a limited fashion so that the deal continues. So the, if Rafah is the last enclave of Hamas, which is a jihadi organization, by the way, which is on our terror list. Imagine, on our terror list. And we are trying to spare them. And we are trying to tell the Israelis, stop your operation. Why? Because Hamas would reclaim its sovereignty. Hamas will get funding, will get training, will get support from the Iran regime. And that will basically break the back, not just of Israel, but also of the other allies we have. The Egyptians had a big problem with Hamas. We never heard about that matter. And also, since they are being so humanitarian, of course there are mistakes. Of course you should, you know, investigate. Aid workers were killed. It deserves an investigation, so on and so forth. But have you ever heard the Biden administration talking, as you said, about October 7th, but also about the genocide in Darfur? Where are your humanitarians? A quarter of a million of people were killed just in 2023. Why is it that you're not talking about them? Because they're Africans, they're black Africans. See, so it's all politicized. It's not about principles being applied. It's about maneuvering to make sure that the interests of the Iran regime via the Iran lobby here in Washington are preserved. And that I'm sorry to hear that.
So sad to be selling out our ally and the West's most important and last defense there in the Middle East, you know, Israel, all for the name of speaking to the people in Dearborn and other enclaves that they're looking for votes for. Final word, you mentioned the support of other nations around the region that, you know, would be sympathetic to getting rid of Hamas and have some sympathies with Israel. What has happened to the coalition of Arab nations that Donald Trump historically formed under the Abraham Accords? Has Joe Biden neglected maintaining and continuing to support and nurture that early coalition, or has he let that fall asunder?
I invite your audience to read my book. Thank you for introducing it. The new book, the latest book, Iran, has the whole explanation. But in a sum, what has happened is it's the double language. In principle, the Biden administration, to please a certain sector of our voters here, and of course to please a certain sector within Israel, said, "Oh, we are committed to the Abraham Accord. This is an achievement," so on and so forth. Guess what they have done? So we are supporting a coalition between Arabs and Israelis, the Abraham Accord. Then we go to the region. On day one, we have removed the Houthi terrorist organization from our list. Who was fighting the Houthis? Saudis, UAE. We put the mother of pressures on our Arab allies to tell them to stop removing the Houthis from Yemen. Guess what we're doing right now? We are defending the international community from the attacks of Houthi. What kind of policy? So we were, meaning the administration was, the major force that dismantled de facto, in reality, the Arab coalition. We put pressure on Riyadh. We said, we're not going to send you weapons. We're not going to honor, these contracts. Same on the UAE and even more on Bahrain. We started to, attack the Bahraini government on the issue of human rights, of course, forgetting that there is a Darfur or anything else. And then we started this pressure on the Israelis. And when our foes, strategic foes like the Iran regime, the Brotherhood, and the jihadists see that the U.S. administration is putting pressure on its allies, we call it in our language here, throwing them under the bus, that's what encourages them. That's why the Iran regime is on steroids today, and the Brotherhood are on steroids. So we basically changed the policy of the previous administration, the Trump administration, and created a new policy in full contradiction. The full reverse is to become the collaborator with the Iran and jihadi organization. That's what the public needs to understand.
Wow. Chilling words and so on point. And I just hope that, folks, you will pick up the book, Iran, an Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy. Stay in touch with Dr. Farris. Boy, there's so much misinformation and doublespeak out there, Waleed. I'm thankful for you coming on and helping straighten us out, because we get so much, just pablum from this administration. Thank you for being with us. Really appreciate it. Look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you, doctor, for having me.
Well, there it is, folks. That's the straight stuff from the guy who understands the Middle East probably more than anyone on the planet, Dr. Waleed Farris. And I've read all of his books from early on after 9/11 and forward. So I'd stay in touch with him. When we come back, your phone calls, 314-912-1019. You wouldn't believe what Jimmy Kimmel said about these United States. That coming up as we wrap it up on the Tober Show.
Oh, what's he gonna do?
Randy Tobler, Truth Warrior, Woke Destroyer, on News Talk STL. Watch us on our live stream using Rumble, Facebook, and Twitter.
Good morning, everybody. Tony Colombo and Katie Fitzpatrick here.
Thanks for listening to the Randy Tobler Show here on News Talk STL. And don't forget to join us every weekday at 2 p.m. for Colombo and Katie.
Also, keep it here for my Saturday morning show, the Bluff City Outdoors Show, today at 11. Now, back to Dr. Randy Tobler. Love you, Doc.
Love you, too, Katie and Tony. Love being with the various folks you hear on air here daily, Monday through Friday. Periodically, I'm with Vic and... and Ken, of course, on Tuesday mornings, and then Tuesday afternoons with Tim and Chris, now that I have that morning slot, and I'm not doing the afternoon show anymore in the Columbia area, so it's good to see. And then with Tony and Katie on Thursdays. So, Jerome, we were talking about young men. We played a Facebook or a Twitter clip earlier of a guy that was so frustrated. You echoed that no matter a great resume, evidence of hard work and leadership and philanthropy and great scores and so forth, you just can't get a look for jobs except for networking through. That's why you're here at News Talk STL with us. And then Scotty writes on the Facebook feed here, "I work with a lot of millennials and Gen Z. In the first responder field, those folks look like Jerome does, give me optimism. There are more young people with Jerome than the kids I work with. Patriotic good work. That's what the lamestream media presents." Gene says, no offense to those like the likes of Jerome, but a lot of young workers, unfortunately, don't have the same work ethic. I think that's generally true. When we hear about work-life balance, Jerome, I think there's a different expectation among many in millennial and Gen Z than there were in previous generations, don't you?
Yeah, and even when we were, in the pre-call section with John the First, he said, I'm going to say some stuff, and I hope you don't take offense to it. And I think that that's been something going on lately where people will sometimes treat me like I'm the outlier. Like, oh, well, you have such a bright future because you are this way, not realizing that I'm also dealing in some ways, not just with the, ASG and the DEI score stuff, but with this generational attitude. Reading, Mean Gene, the Dancing Machines comment, he said he agreed with John about that and no offense to me. And I don't take offense by it, but it is a bit disheartening because I can't control the actions of others. And I'm sure that there are people my age or even younger that are outperforming me on, every metric. Some people are just that talented or that amazing when it comes to that stuff. But one of the things John said is, when he's looking for who he employs, and I've been a manager, so I know how to look at resumes. I know kind of how to do the interview process with people. But he said it doesn't matter about the GPA. He wants to know the adversity that you've been through that got you there. And like I said, I never would have thought that it would be something to put on my portfolio, and maybe I should, but I don't think saying, hey, I was homeless during COVID, I grew up in a single mother household with in a gang ridden territory. Hey, and he said that clubs don't matter. He wants to know what we can do. But I was was club president. So I wasn't just some kid that joined in and sat in some meetings. I was participating in the student government and helping them with their COVID policies and talking with other clubs and networking. I was doing side gigs and I was doing part-time work. And I have an entire portfolio even that I submit with every single resume in my related fields. And so that's something that I think is, I agree and I'm not offended. And I do agree that, looking at numbers on a paper or letters on a report card don't tell you a lot about a candidate. But when it's not that I'm failing the interviews, and it's not that people I know that are just as qualified as me. I knew a guy who did all kinds of lab work. He completed an internship for wildlife management and was extremely passionate about the environment, extremely passionate in wildlife management. This guy, I think, would have made a great forest ranger or something like that. And he's working as a dental assistant because he just cannot get any opportunity to even work a lower paying or, because I'm not expecting, $100,000 a year right out of college. I know I have to work my way up and establish myself and prove myself, but I think that that's where some of this frustration for my generation comes from, is that there are a lot of people on social media and a lot of people out and about that they legitimately just do not care. They have no ambition. You'll give them a chance and then they will betray that chance, like what one of the comments was talking about. But at the same time, it's that idea of how do I differentiate myself if you're not going to consider my contributions to my community, my contributions. And I won 7 awards. I got letters of recommendation from my professors that had PhDs and worked in the field saying, hey, hire this guy, hire him. And maybe it's the hiring manager. Maybe it's whoever is responsible, the HR people responsible for looking at that. Maybe they just don't care.
I mean, you said it earlier, Jerome. I mean, look, you can have all the letters of recommendation and all the documentation of your leadership in extracurricular clubs, public service organizations, whatever. If you don't even get a look because they see that you're white, because that's usually required on applications, isn't it? Your ethnicity?
Yep. So they might see I'm a white male. I identify as a white male. And
so you don't get any look. They can't even look at that. That's the whole point. That's what we're talking about. You don't even get in front of the Johns of the world if they're in an HR world. And here's the problem. John, he says he owns his own company. He's got this and that. Small business people are gradually being squeezed out by the HR, ESG dominant, big consolidated mega companies, because they lobby for regulations which squeeze competition. And maybe the little guy who would like to get you in front of him, he's struggling to stay alive, much less hire another person. Right. I mean, that's the problem. So I'm telling you, man, I think the only answer here is a second parallel economy. I'm telling you, I think the next time I go into a doctor, I'm just going to have some fun and say, you know what? I want to see a white doctor over 50. Because you've just told me in the American medical colleges, many of our training institutions in medicine, they're buying very flawed studies that black babies do better in the neonatal intensive care when they're taken care of by black doctors. That's true. And then the people who defend this go on and say, well, that's, you know, there's a natural, people will perceive that there's more sympathy towards their own type. That is biologically true. But if that's true, then it should cut both ways. White people should be able to say, I want a white doctor. Women are already doing it in the OBGYN field, and I respect that. I want a female doctor. A lot of men that have been in the field for a long time used to get offended by that. I'm no longer offended. If that's the reality, that's the reality. You know, God bless you. But if you as a white person say, I want a white doctor, oh my God, take him to jail, handcuff him, he's some kind of a racist. No, I'm just saying what you say. We like the same kind of people we like. It works for black. You have the black student union, don't you? I don't see the white student union.
You would never.
I don't know. I think you're right. The only way we're going to fight back is to stick together. And, you know, if you don't like progressive companies, don't deal with progressive companies. Let's start the white, not the white, the conservative Angie's list. Let's start the conservative Angie's list. Let's do that. All right. Hey, we had good conversation. Thanks for all joining us. I hope you have a fabulous weekend. It's going to warm up a little bit. Protect your eyes and watch the solar eclipse with the right kind of protection or through a shoebox with a pinhole in it. You know how to do that. If not, there's a NASA clip that I'll put on the Facebook page. Thanks for being with us this and every week. We'll see you next time.